Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participant lines are in the listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on chronic myelogenous leukemia, or CML, from the 2011 American Society of Hematology, or ASH, annual meeting. And this is a workshop that I know many of you wait for each year, and we're delighted to be able to offer it today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 864 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of the country, from large cities and small cities, and also from rural areas and suburban areas. And we also have international participants from Canada, China, Indonesia, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from, it's really a global call. You're really from all over the world. And today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers. There's also information about all the different collaborating organizations as resources to you. And there's an outline of what our speakers will be covering. And there also is an evaluation form. I'm going to ask all of you to take a moment at the end of our program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can really best tell us the programs you'd like us to offer and the topics that are most interesting for you and most relevant to meet your needs. So please do take a moment at the end of the program and complete those evaluations. We see all of you as really consultants in helping us to plan programs that best meet your needs. So tell us what you want, and we'll very much try to offer that for you. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Stephen Coutre. He's Associate Professor of Medicine, Director, Hematology Clinic, Stanford University School of Medicine. And Dr. Coutre is going to address an overview of CML, new treatment approaches reported at ASH, and doctor-patient communication. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Coutre.
Thank you. So I'll start with a bit of an overview. As all of you know, this is a chronic leukemia. It's a leukemia, so it involves the blood and the bone marrow as an organ system. And it's different than our acute leukemia. So in fact, you may be diagnosed incidentally when a blood count is obtained for another reason, or perhaps you have fatigue that prompts a blood count showing anemia, or maybe even some abdominal discomfort and you're found to have an enlarged spleen. But establishing the diagnosis is very straightforward, and really the hallmark of this leukemia is what's called the Philadelphia chromosome, where two different chromosomes swap pieces, forming this new chromosome we call the Philadelphia chromosome. The two genes that are put together are called BCR and ABLE, so you'll hear us talking about BCR-ABLE as well. Now, our goals when we treat are to achieve normalization of the blood counts, and these days, virtually everybody achieves that result with the drugs that we have. The next step is to get a complete cytogenetic remission, meaning that you can no longer detect the Philadelphia chromosome. So that's a very important goal, and you need to discuss with your doctor how you're going to achieve that and how you're going to measure that. And then finally, we have an even more sensitive test for those individuals who achieve a complete chromosome response, and that's called the BCR-ABLE test, or PCR is the test that we use. And what you need to keep in mind is that we have a goal with that test as well, and that goal is to achieve a major molecular response. So everybody that we treat for this disease, that's ultimately what we're aiming for. And the reason for that is because we know if we achieve that goal, then your chance of progressing, of having the disease move on to an acute leukemia, is extremely small. So keeping that in mind, think of the tests that we have. We want to look at the chromosome response. We want to look at this BCR-ABLE response. Now, at ASH this year, we actually had quite a bit of information, updates from some clinical trials, and some exciting news about new drugs as well. So as many of you know, the treatment for this disease for years now has been a drug called imatinib, or Gleevec, which completely revolutionized the treatment of CML. We also have two newer drugs, so-called second-generation drugs, nilotinib, or Tasigna, and dasatinib, or Sprycel. These drugs were initially approved for patients intolerant of Gleevec or who had developed resistance to the drug, but subsequent trials have allowed them to be approved for initial therapy as well, and some of you may have started on one of these two drugs as your initial treatment for CML. So at ASH, we had an update from these trials. So for example, the trial with nilotinib, we had now a three-year follow-up, and it continued to show benefit in favor of nilotinib compared to imatinib or Gleevec. So in this trial, they were looking at that major molecular response. Remember what our goal is in treatment. And initially, at 12 months, there was a difference. About 25% of patients on Gleevec achieved this goal at 12 months, versus about half the patients on nilotinib. And now with further follow-up, with three-year follow-up, both groups improved, but the difference still remains. So now about half the patients on Gleevec had achieved that goal, and almost three-quarters on nilotinib. I think more importantly, however, is looking at those patients who progressed to the accelerated phase or the blast crisis, because that, of course, is what we fear the most. Once that happens, it's much more difficult to treat the disease effectively, even with a transplant, and so we really want to avoid that at all costs. So the initial results showed us that nilotinib was superior to imatinib, even though only about 4% of patients had progressed on imatinib to the more advanced phases compared to 1% or less with nilotinib, it was a significant difference. So fundamentally, fewer patients progressed if they started with nilotinib. There was a similar trial with dasatinib or Sprycel, which is taken once a day compared to imatinib, and that trial also showed a benefit in terms of the molecular response and in terms of progression to the advanced phase. We had some update at this meeting as well. For example, at 12 months, the major molecular response with this drug was 83%. In fact, about a third of those patients had no detectable disease, no detectable BCR-ABL. Now, that data was from an earlier trial. It wasn't a trial compared to imatinib, but it still was quite impressive to see that you had responses that were this good. Now, you may hear about trying to decide how well you're doing on therapy at earlier time points and making decisions earlier about potentially switching therapy. There's a lot of work going on in this area. I think this is still a concept that is sometimes difficult to understand, and certainly for most community oncologists, it's not something that they're very familiar with. So I wouldn't try to implement this in practice, but if you're seen at a major academic center by a physician who's quite experienced in treating CML, they may put more focus on this. So for example, looking at the quality of the response, even after 3 months, can sometimes be predictive of how you are eventually going to respond to the treatment. So if you're very proactive, you may look at earlier time points and help make decisions. But again, I would really reserve those kinds of decisions to very experienced physicians treating CML. Finally, we also have data regarding investigational drugs. So unfortunately, some patients do develop resistance to the drugs that we have available. In fact, there is one mutation that can occur that renders resistance to all three of our approved drugs. This is commonly called the T315I mutation. And it really renders resistance, complete resistance, to each of these three drugs. So unless you have a transplant option, it can be difficult to manage the disease. There is a drug that remains investigational, but clinical trials have been completed. It's called ponatinib. It's also an oral drug taken once a day. And the trial was done in patients who were resistant to the drugs like dasatinib or nilotinib, as well as imatinib. It was also looked at in patients with a different leukemia that also has the Philadelphia chromosome. And the take-home message from this experience is that the drug is very effective even in patients with this resistant mutation. So, in fact, of the patients with that specific mutation, more than half achieved a complete chromosomal remission. In contrast, of course, if you had taken any of the three approved drugs, you wouldn't really see any response at all. So it has particular efficacy against that mutation. And for other patients who are intolerant or resistant to our standard drugs for other reasons, it also had activity. So we're now awaiting review by the FDA of these sorts of trial results to see if this will become another approved drug that we have available for patients who need something more than what is currently available. And the final topic to discuss that was presented at ASH, we have some update here, has to do with how long to treat. So there have been some ongoing trials looking at whether or not you could eventually stop treatment with imatinib. The greatest experience, of course, treating CML, the longest experience, has been with imatinib or Gleevec. And so the trials have really focused on patients who have been on the drug for a number of years. These are the so-called STEM trials that have been performed in Europe. And we had an update at ASH. This trial involved 100 patients who had been on Gleevec for at least 3 years and had achieved a complete molecular remission for at least 2 years. So not just a major remission, but a complete, where you could not detect BCR-ABL at all for over 2 years. And their drug was stopped. And now the initial experience suggested that some patients had a rather rapid recurrence of BCR-ABL. It can be detected again. And others seem to still remain negative. So with longer follow-up now, there were about 40% of patients who remained negative without detectable BCR-ABL anywhere from 24 to 36 months after stopping the drug. And in fact, there were no relapses observed after 2 years. So it seemed to be that if the disease was to be detectable again, it happened rather soon. So for example, remember there were 100 patients, 58 relapses occurred within 7 months. It was very early. And there were only 3 relapses after a year and a half. Interestingly, they reported that all of those patients who had detectable disease again responded to restarting the imatinib. So I think this is still a work in progress, and what will be important will be identifying upfront who is most likely to maintain a remission after stopping the drug. That'll help us decide which patients it's safe to go ahead and stop. For now, outside of a clinical trial, I certainly don't advocate stopping the drug unless there's a very specific reason, an intolerance or something like that. But it is interesting to see that there might be individuals where the disease remains undetectable for prolonged periods of time. Finally, I'll just end up by emphasizing that having a good dialogue with your treating physician is extremely important, and it really starts from the very beginning. It starts from that conversation about the diagnosis, what the disease is, what to expect in your day-to-day life, decision about which of these three drugs to start with, what to expect in terms of response, and I think it's important to understand our goals, as I mentioned, normalize the blood counts, then see elimination, disappearance of the Philadelphia chromosome, and then move towards this major molecular response. So you have to understand what to expect at certain time points. I think you need to understand what potential side effects there are from the medication so you can report to your physician if you're experiencing any of these. And then finally, as you continue on treatment, it's really an understanding of how we are going to monitor the disease. And, you know, we report back to you what these numbers are, but I think the more you understand their significance, the better you'll be able to feel that, feel confident that your disease is being managed adequately and it's being controlled. Because I think with CML specifically, it's all about treating it effectively, early, and being vigilant about maintaining control of the disease. And if we're able to do that, I think we've already shown that we can continue controlling this disease for many, many, many years. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Dr. O'Brien.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Couture. That's a wonderful presentation, just excellent, really presenting on the CML, what it is and how it's treated, and really the goal of treatment. An excellent presentation, really outstanding. And our next speaker is Dr. Susan O'Brien. Dr. O'Brien is a professor of medicine, Department of Leukemia, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. O'Brien is going to address how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, understanding the important role of adherence, or taking your pills on schedule, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. O'Brien.
Thank you. Well, Steve gave you the overview of the treatment, and I guess I'm talking about somewhat softer things, if you will, instead of actually treatment outcomes. So I'll be a little bit less dependent on data, but I will talk about some data. As was mentioned, the first thing I was asked to address is how clinical trials contribute to treatment options. And I think for people who have CML, it's probably pretty obvious that how do we get a drug approved and out there for everybody to use? Well, we have to have a clinical trial that shows that the drug is safe, relatively, and works, produces responses, and is usually even better than the treatment we had before. Now, the obvious huge leap forward was when we first had Gleevec come on the market, or imatinib. And that's because up until then, the treatment was interferon. And although interferon could be effective, and we actually have patients out with no evidence of CML 20 years later, that was, number one, the minority of patients. And number two, that was a drug that had to be given subcutaneously, so an injection every day, and had quite a lot of side effects, including neurologic side effects, fatigue, depression, many others. So now we went from there to this pill that was not only producing more responses, but, as you all know, for the most part, not having a lot of side effects. So that was obviously a huge leap forward when we went to targeted therapy. So then people said, well, CML is such a good disease now. I guess we can kind of stop there. But that's not actually true, because as some of you may know, there are some patients who, although find it useful in terms of getting them into remission, as the endpoints that Steve was talking about, have a fair number of side effects. And usually in a clinical trial, we will grade side effects and only stop the treatment or change treatments if they're really severe, like grade 3 to 4. Well, most people wouldn't have what we would call grade 3 to 4. But, you know, what is grade 2? Well, grade 2, for example, if you have diarrhea, is 7 or more bowel movements a day. Well, that might not be such a great thing in the long run for a pill that you have to take every single day of your life. So what can be tolerable side effects if you're taking a treatment for a couple days a month may become relatively intolerable because of the chronic nature of it and the fact that you have to deal with it every single day. So although it's uncommon, there are some people that really find it a problem to take Gleevec or imatinib. In addition, there are some people who don't get the response endpoints that were described by Dr. Couture, that they don't have the optimal response that we know is going to translate into long-term benefit. And so there are a cohort of patients who need other treatments because they're having an inferior response. And so that led to the development, as you heard, of what we call second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And the two that came along at pretty much the same time, as you heard from Dr. Couture, are Sprycel, which is dasatinib, or Tasigna, which is nilotinib. And both of them appear to be effective in patients who either have toxicities to Gleevec or have a lack of response. And so obviously we wouldn't have any of these drugs without clinical trials. The other reason it can be very important, Dr. Couture also touched on, which is, for example, if you're in the subgroup of patients who have resistant disease and have that T315I mutation, what you know is that all of the currently available drugs don't work that well. So what do you do? Well, there is this very effective drug that Dr. Couture just described, but as of right now, because it's not yet FDA approved, although we expect it will be possibly by next year, as of right now, if you're a patient with that problem, that participation in the clinical trial is in fact what gives you the best treatment option for you at this point in time, because all of the FDA approved treatment options are not that effective in that small subset of patients. So I think it's very obvious how trials contribute to treatment options. The other thing I was asked to talk about is adherence, and this is a major issue in CML, and we're finding, unfortunately, more and more that people just don't take their pills. And I think that as CML doctors, we were initially very surprised by this information, because if you think about it, you know, number one, people with leukemia have cancer, which is kind of a scary word. And as I mentioned, these drugs are really pretty well tolerated. Some people don't have any side effects with them whatsoever. And yet we would find out often as time went on that people were skipping doses or not taking doses. And I think there are probably several different reasons for this. I think in some cases people just are doing so well that psychologically they kind of don't want to take them anymore. They think, I'm in remission, I don't need this treatment. But you just heard from Dr. Couture that if you're going to be stopped, it should really be done under very controlled circumstances. I think sometimes people are having side effects like I mentioned earlier. You know, you're having diarrhea 5-6 times a day. Well, yeah, you can live with it, but who wants to live with it? And there are medications that can be used to deal with these side effects, but sometimes they continue to be a problem. The good news is when we only had one tyrosine kinase inhibitor, you kind of were stuck. You either went with those side effects or you didn't have a really good treatment. But as you just heard, we now have three and potentially a fourth one that may be approved in the next year. And the good news is there is nice clinical trial data that people who get side effects with one drug do not necessarily get side effects with the other drug. And so nowadays, rather than just not taking it and saying, oh, I have too many things to do today, I don't want to deal with this, you can tell your doctor, you know, this is really impacting my quality of life. And yeah, I know my leukemia is doing well, but this is becoming such an issue for me that I wonder if we could talk about alternative therapies. So don't be shy about talking to your doctor about that, because in people who really have constant bothersome side effects, we know as physicians that as of right now, this is a lifelong therapy for most people. As time goes on, we may find out that with longer follow-up, we can stop people, but we don't really know that yet outside the data that Dr. Couture just showed you from that one trial. So we understand that side effects that might be tolerable in the short term are not maybe going to be so tolerable with the expectation that it's going to be lifelong. And so that can be a viable reason, rather than just skipping pills or dropping your dose, sometimes to change the treatment. Sometimes the dose can be reduced, but there are certain lower levels of doses that we know if we go below them, the treatment doesn't work very well. And so it's important for you not to just lower the dose yourself and think, well, I'm doing well at this dose, I may do just as well on half the dose, for example. I think another reason people don't take it, unfortunately, is finances. A lot of people have very high copays for these medications, and this is not an easy issue to solve. I mean, I've had people admit to me, well, I'm only taking it every other day because it's really a financial burden, and I need to make it last longer. And admittedly, that's the hardest problem to deal with. And partly that's a fluke of how chemo is paid for, as you all know or may not know. Inpatient coverage, particularly for Medicare, is totally different than outpatient coverage. But that's really started in the days when outpatient coverage wasn't chemo, because we didn't have 20 years ago outpatient chemo or outpatient treatments for cancers that could be given by mouth. And now that we have outpatient oral chemos, and not just in CML but in other diseases, there is a big push now, and Congress is looking into this, to possibly pass a law that says that the coverage for outpatient chemo pills should be as good as what's done inpatient, and not like the kind of copays you have for your antihypertensive, where that might amount to $10, particularly if it's a generic. So that's admittedly a problem, but there are some of these agencies like Leukemia Lymphoma Society, et cetera, that can help with some of this kind of thing, and it's important to look into that and not just stop taking the treatment. Do I, in fact, know, is there any data that if patients are less adherent to medication, they do worse? Yes, there's actually published trials where they did a very tricky thing. They put a sort of a special detector on the cap of the bottle. They told the patient, so they knew. And they also had them fill out a diary, but then they could tell any time the cap of the bottle was opened or not open. And the findings were simply amazing. And again, this is published in a medical journal, that many people would come in to visit their physician and say, yeah, I've only missed a dose here or there, not too much. And it would turn out they had missed, say, 25% of their doses. And what they then showed in that report is that there was a clear correlation between the high percentage of missing doses and lack of response or lack of an optimal response. So we absolutely know that adherence or taking your pills is very, very important to getting where you want to be. And again, what fits into what I'm talking about now is the quality of life issue. And I think that, as I said, most of these drugs are extremely well tolerated, but there are side effects, and we just talked about them, where they are going to be problematic in the long run. And again, I think when we just had one tyrosine kinase inhibitor, people kind of had to bite the bullet, because it was still a lot better in terms of side effects than interferon, which is what we had had previous to that. But now, again, there are different side effects with each of these drugs. They don't necessarily overlap. And so it's very important that if you're going to get to the point where your quality of life is really has a significantly impacted in a poor way, that you can talk to your physician and consider possibly changing to another treatment. Because now we are in the lucky position of having, as I said, three FDA-approved drugs and another drug we all think will be potentially approved by next year, which will give us four of them. And so there are options there to try and deal with side effects if you have them and if they're really becoming intolerable. So I think I'll stop there.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. O'Brien, for a really outstanding presentation and really for covering many of the issues that people living with CML experience in terms of decisions and quality of life issues. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Essie Roman. Essie is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care, and she's coordinator of our social work programs here. And I'm going to turn the program over to Essie, and she's going to address the free psychosocial support services that you can access from Cancer Care. Essie?
Thank you, Carolyn, and it's a pleasure to be part of this telephone education workshop. I'd like to start by talking about the importance of having support when you're diagnosed with CML and how Cancer Care and our Hopeline can be of help to you. As we've learned from today's workshop, there's a lot of information about CML to take in, and sometimes it's hard to understand what this means for you. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer, like CML, affects a person, their family, partners, and friends. We are also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the problems that come along with the disease, such as practical and financial demands, physical changes, and the social and emotional impact of CML. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis of CML is an important part of your journey, and you don't have to face it alone. Cancer Care can help in many ways, such as our practical and a financial help. We can also offer you other financial assistance resources. Our emotional support services are provided by licensed oncology social workers in a variety of settings, such as telephone counseling, online, and telephone support groups. We realize that cancer affects the whole family and the entire family. Asking for help by contacting a cancer care social worker for counseling or by joining a support group is a sign of strength. Through our counseling service, it can afford you the time to talk about your individual needs, concerns, questions, any questions that you may have. Counseling can help you explore the tools you need in order to cope. For many people living with cancer, talking to a social worker relieves them from the stress of holding it all inside and shielding loved ones from their struggles. Cancer Care offers a wide variety of support groups as well. In addition to offering support groups for people with cancer, we also offer support groups for family members, partners, caregivers, and loved ones. Many people find in a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situations or have similar problems. We offer telephone and online support groups. Individual counseling and support groups are a safe place where you can talk about your concerns and your fears. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people experience. Feeling emotionally well can help you better deal with your diagnosis of CML and the treatment you face. All of our services are provided completely free of charge. If you would like to speak with an oncology social worker, please contact our 1-800-813-4673, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org for more information. In addition, as you know, our Connect education workshops provided both disease-specific information such as today's workshop and workshops on coping with the physical, emotional impact of cancer. Our fact sheets are booklets packed with up-to-date information on treatment and the latest coping strategies to help people diagnosed with cancer and those who care for them. These two additional tools that can help you. Again, all of these materials are free of charge. Lastly, I'd like to conclude with, please remember that you're not alone. While we may not be able to eliminate the problems you experience, we are here for you, and Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you so much, Effie, and thank you for your very compassionate presentation about all the services that everyone on the call can access from Cancer Care. So thank you very much for that and for just being so compassionate about that. And now we have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board. And we're going to try to take as many questions as possible. Trinitha will explain to you how to queue up for questions, and I guess we'll, Trinitha, if you would explain how to queue up for questions, and then we'll start.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered, or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question is from Rita R. Your question, please.
Hi. My 21-year-old son was diagnosed with CML at age 13. He has been PCR negative for 8 years now, and at this point, we would like to get into some kind of program which would follow him in being able to come off this drug. Now, I've looked on the Internet, and I haven't found any institutions where he could get involved in this type of program. Can you guide me as to how to get him into one of these programs?
Rita, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Coutre to address your question.
Well, as far as I'm aware, the clinical trials involving stopping the medication are in Europe. Dr. O'Brien may know if there's anything at her institution, for example. But if there aren't any available here, then it's still an issue of it doesn't have to be done in the context of a clinical trial, though that's preferable. But if you have a very experienced physician who understands CML, you really have to make that decision together regarding stopping the drug and then monitoring to see if there's any evidence of recurrence. And monitoring is generally very straightforward. It involves that PCR test, which can be done on the peripheral blood.
Dr. O'Brien, did you want to add anything?
No, I agree with Steve. I'm not aware of any trials here, but also it can be done outside of a trial. The reason we don't recommend it routinely is because the monitoring has to be there. But as Steve just said, the monitoring can be done outside a trial.
And Dr. Coutre and Dr. O'Brien, is this something that occurs very frequently? Is this this is an excellent question that Rita's posing, but is it something that is that is in clinical practice frequently, or is it something that really she would want to search out an expert center for?
Well, a situation like this, it's certainly unusual for a number of reasons. Just her son being as young as he was when he was diagnosed, that's not your typical CML. And I think if you are making this decision to stop therapy, it really should be done under the guidance of a CML specialist, because they'll know if they need to intervene sooner. There's a lot of education that still needs to go on in terms of what these tests mean. We get contacted all the time about these PCR tests, and you find that a lot of community physicians in practice don't really understand what the numbers are or what the significance is. So in a situation like this, it really should be done by a physician at an academic center who has a large experience treating patients with CML.
And actually, Rita, I'm going to call you after the call as well, because we want to be sure to offer you any services that we can help you in your search. So thank you for raising that excellent question. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Wes Kay. Your question, please.
First of all, I'd like to compliment our two MD presenters. As a father of a young lady that went through med school starting 90, I know how tough it's to get from here to there. You folks did a phenomenal job of talking about CML and treatments, et cetera. So my hat's off to you. I was diagnosed 3 years ago this month. At the time, I was 68, so I'm 71. And I've done really well on Gleevec. One of the questions I have, and I've listened to some of the cancer care workshops on adherence to time of day, my oncologist suggests that I'm pretty flexible time of day, and I always make sure that I take it at dinner time after food, but dinner time might float to 5, 4:30, 5, 6, something like that. And during the almost 3 years I've been on Gleevec, I've only missed it once or twice, so I know how important it is to take that pill. The issues that I have, and I'm looking for more suggestions, tired, and I know because I'm borderline anemic based on the blood test, and my oncologist, who's terrific, says not much you can do about it, so I don't know if you folks have some suggestions. The other thing I have
question?
Is...
Oh, your question, Wes?
My question is a tiredness. My question is quad muscle issues and like a ticklish cough. Is there things I can do with that?
Oh, excellent. Those are great, excellent questions. And Dr. O'Brien, do you want to start with those?
Yeah, anemia is an issue that can occur, I will say, with all of the drugs. I mentioned that a lot of the toxicities, when you move from one to the other, are less likely to happen. Unfortunately, probably the one that's most likely to happen in terms of can occur with any of them are lowering of some of the other counts, and anemia may be an issue. Again, it depends what the drug is and what the dose of the drug is, because there is room to go down somewhat on the FDA-approved doses. So again, on imatinib or Gleevec, we generally wouldn't want to go below 300. But on the other drugs, the newer drugs, Tasigna and Sprycel, there's a lot of room to maneuver in terms of going down on the dose and still seeing reasonable responses. So it really depends on how severe the fatigue is, how significant the anemia is, and the person's response. 3 months is early, but assuming that the response at 3 months was good, then that might be something where the dose could be reduced. It's probably the thing I would be least likely to change over to other medications for, because to some extent you will get that with all of them. But that is a consideration. But generally, I wouldn't do that unless it was severe. It sounded from the way it was being described like it was pretty mild. And the cramps are a common issue with a Gleevec or imatinib that are actually less common with the other two TKIs. That being said, if somebody gets a cramp now and then, I have to admit, usually that's not something I think where either the patient or the doctor would really think that that's a significant enough side effect. But certainly that is more common with Gleevec and less common with the second generation TKIs.
Okay, excellent. And the ticklish throat, did you address that? You probably did. Or
ticklish throat, that's a new one on me.
Okay, all right. Okay, so we would definitely encourage you, Wes, to take what you heard here and go back to your treating healthcare team with any of any other concerns that you might have. And thank you for your questions. We do have a question from one of our online participants, and the question is, if you become resistant to a drug, do you need a washout period before starting other therapy? Dr. Coutre, could you address that?
No, the simple answer is no. If you have an intolerance to a drug, a significant side effect, let's say, then, it's certainly nice to have those symptoms go away before you restart something, but you don't need to wash a drug out, per se.
And the second question is the goal of the same type of remission the same in third-line therapy?
Yes, your goal is still to get the best response you can, because that correlates with a better chance of not having the disease progress. And that's really the ultimate goal, not having it change into one of the more advanced phases.
So I have another question from one of our online participants. Again, a 15-year-old son has been on Gleevec 400 milligrams a day for 5 years. He has had a complete molecular remit response. He has random rashes and joint aches, knees and ankles, and is tired often. Are these common side effects? Dr. O'Brien?
What treatment did you say he was on?
Gleevec, 400 milligrams a day.
Yeah, I mean, you said rash. Well, rash can occur with any of the drugs, actually, and is probably a little bit more likely to occur with the other drugs. You mentioned rash, fatigue, and what else?
And joint aches, knees and ankles. And
yeah, joint aches or bone aches can also be common. You can get them from the CML by itself, and then you can sometimes, even in people having a very good response, they still persist. And I think that we don't really know why in some people, even though the disease appears to be going away and they're meeting the endpoints that were described by Dr. Coutre, they still have significant what we call arthralgias, which are bone pains. Steve may want to comment on this. I'm not sure that that's a side effect that necessarily benefits from changing treatment. In my experience, I think that's probably one, interestingly, that tends to occur in younger people for whatever reason, so this would fit with the history, and tends to be much more so in men. But again, I've never really, that's my experience, I've never heard anybody describe why that would be. And usually, it can be treated with mild pain medication or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, but I'm not aware of any data to suggest that it's more prevalent with one than the other, but Steve might want to comment.
No, I would agree. And, of course, your option is always changing and trying a different agent. But, someone like this who's had such a great response for such a long period of time, you're really reticent to do that, unless the symptoms really just are, intolerable, really significantly affecting quality of life, because you always fear that you might be introducing a new set of side effect profile by changing to another drug. So fortunately, it's uncommon that you really have to switch somebody simply because of intolerance.
And we have another question from another one of our participants, one of our online participants. Well, what are some of the long-term side effects of Gleevec? So long-term.
Basically, the nice thing about all of these drugs is that so far we have not really found long-term side effects that are new in the sense that you don't see them early on in the treatment. Now, let's keep in mind that, you know, Gleevec or imatinib has been around now for, maybe 15 years max, including the original clinical trial data before it was FDA approved. And these newer drugs have only been around for a couple of years. So I will say that, make that statement cautiously, that certainly with the newer drugs, we don't have five or even, well, we might have five with some of the initial trials, but certainly we don't have 10-year follow-up on those trials. And so are there going to be late side effects that come very, very late in the treatment? Don't know, but the good news is that up until now, particularly with Gleevec, where we have the longest follow-up because that was the first drug, there have not been sudden, bizarre new side effects that have occurred, say, 10 years into treatment that were not seen initially.
A question about the aches that people were describing. Do you find that people sometimes work with other disciplines in healthcare, perhaps physical activity of people or rehab medicine or physical therapy? Does that offer any help to people in terms of there have been a couple of people who have asked about just the kind of cramps and muscle aches. Is that?
Well, I have, you know, some patients, for example, who pursue alternate therapies, whether it be something like acupuncture or even herbal remedies, you know, under the guidance of an experienced practitioner. Anecdotally, some find that helpful. I doubt that, you know, traditional physical therapy would really alleviate these kinds of symptoms, but it may be worth an evaluation. You get some recommendations regarding exercises you can do. Often the one gentleman mentioned the quad muscles, you know, step exercises to strengthen the quads, that might be beneficial. So it's certainly worth trying.
And always in conjunction with your treating healthcare team. So anything you do, acupuncture, the herbal activity, always run it past your treating healthcare team. And can you comment on that? Because you're talking about long-term relationships with your healthcare team, and so the importance of really sharing concerns or issues that come up, really working very closely with your physician. And Dr. Couture, do you want to comment on that? And then also Dr.
Yeah, I guess the way I've kind of always looked at it and talked about it to patients is that, you know, there may be a role for both. And as long as a practitioner recognizes that they may have something to offer, but also acknowledges the benefit and the value of traditional medicine, then I think you're probably working with a responsible individual. The ones that I'm afraid of are the ones who really reject traditional medicine, really pursue very, therapies that are potentially harmful. And, of course, you know, the supplement industry is a huge industry, and a lot of supplements are natural products. They're derived from plants or what have you, and there's no doubt that many of these will have some kind of biological activity. So I think that one has to approach it with some caution and with moderation. So it should always be under someone's guidance. You shouldn't just go to, you know, GNC and ask for the immune booster preparation, for example. And if you do have some kind of medicine that you're taking, alternate medicine, always bring it in so we can look at it and see if it seems like it's reasonable.
Excellent. Dr. O'Brien, did you want to add?
Yeah, no, I have nothing to add. I totally agree with Steve. I think most physicians are willing, you know, as long as they don't know that there's anything negative about the product, certainly are willing to let their patients try things like that. But we'd like to know what it is before kind of agreeing to it.
And there's a question from someone about what's the course of treatment for people whose CML is in remission. How often do they need to be monitored? So just that monitoring process. Dr. O'Brien, could you address that?
Yeah, I mean, the monitoring initially is different than the monitoring later. So initially, you know, we want to make sure that the patient is getting to the endpoint that we want to get to, which is a complete cytogenetic response. Once the patient's in complete cytogenetic response, we often like to see people get to a major molecular response, and that's monitored by the PCR. So we follow patients a little more closely in the beginning to see when, you know, to make sure that they're getting to the response we want. But then when they're actually in that response, it's a little bit more, a little bit less clear. I believe the NCCN guidelines, which both Steve and I belong to, have suggested that initially the PCR should be every 3 months, and then in patients who've been in remission for a couple of years could go to every 6 months. Remember that the PCR is done on the peripheral blood, so this is just a simple blood test and not a test that requires bone marrow.
And the other question that we have here is just about someone who has a family member with CML. Do they need to worry about the possibility of developing CML themselves? So for family members.
No, there's no data to suggest that this is a hereditary disease, no.
Excellent, okay. So that's obviously, that's a relief to anyone asking that question or being concerned about family members in terms of screening. And the other question is, does having CML make me more likely to develop other types of cancer? Dr.
No.
Coutre?
No, in general, no.
And then just to kind of, in conclusion, a general question for both of you is to kind of just kind of wrap things up in terms of what do you see as being new on the horizon in terms of the treatment of people who are living with CML in terms of, what kinds of things do you look into the future, even based on the post-ASH meeting that you would see happening for them?
Well, I would say, you know, fortunately, we're doing very, very, very well. And we have several options in terms of therapies that we can use. So, for example, if you have unusual side effects, we can often confidently switch to another drug that works equally well but doesn't have that profile. And then, like I mentioned, for those individuals who have that unusual resistant mutation or other reasons to not respond to the drugs we have, I think ponatinib is going to be a very good alternative. So I think that's going to be the most positive step forward that we have in the near future. I talked briefly about looking at earlier time points and trying to make decisions about maybe switching therapy early, et cetera. I think that's still very much premature, certainly on any a large-scale practice. And, you know, we, of course, will continue to pursue questions like that in the setting of trials and in academic centers, but things like that really aren't ready for prime time. So I think the message is that still is that we're doing very, very, very well and to always remain vigilant and not forget that that we need to continue to monitor to make sure that our patients remain in remission, hit the landmarks that we're looking for.
Thank you. Dr. O'Brien, do you wish to?
Yeah, no, I agree with Steve. I mean, there are still some interest in developing vaccines in CML with the idea of, say, people who get a major molecular response but don't get a complete molecular response. Now, that endpoint is still associated with excellent survival, but, for example, those are people we would never take off the drug, because they're still showing a low level of disease. And the feeling is that the immune system, once you get down to a low level, may be able to control the disease, and that's why these people do really well, even though at a very low level of, you know, 1 in 10,000 cells, you can still detect disease. So there's interest in potentially using vaccine strategies or even low doses of interferon or other things to kind of jump the immune system and see if you can get those people who have a really good response but need to continue on drug indefinitely, if you can get them to be completely molecular remission, because those are the patient population where we could at least think about stopping treatment. So there are still some interesting clinical trials looking at vaccines, but certainly none of them are ready for prime time. I think the option that's the closest to being available for everybody, as was mentioned several times and just now by Steve, is the ponatinib.
Well, I really want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been really outstanding, and this has been an extraordinary program. And I want to thank all of you who have asked questions, either on the phone or online, and all of you who have been listening as well. And I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour education workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I just want to remind all of you about the services that you can access from Cancer Care, and those services are all free. We have a staff of 45 master's level trained oncology social workers, much like S.C. Roman, and we're here to provide a host of services to you, from practical and financial assistance to counseling, both individual counseling and a chance to talk to someone one-on-one, and group counseling, a chance to talk with someone with a group, both on the telephone or online, whichever is more preferable to you. We also, of course, are just available to answer your questions or be helpful to you. And we do offer these telephone workshops, these education workshops that you can participate in, as well as we have lots of booklets and fact sheets so that we hopefully have something for each of you, any question or concern you might have, and we would encourage you to take advantage of the services that we have that are free and to call us at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, I do not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with CML, with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support and that we are here to help you. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.